This week's parsha is Parsha Shlach. And the title is Ways to Recognize Toxic Friendships. Anybody ever had a toxic friend? Suzanne is giving me the shake of yes. Scott, ever had a toxic friend?
Yeah, yeah. Blocked them, you know, unfriended them. Just, yeah.
All right, so we're now going to ways to recognize toxic friends. Let's go to the SSA. Share video. Okay. I'm going to do a share. Here we go.
You do not need to apply a scientific method to know that having friends is extremely beneficial. Besides the developmental benefits, having friends opens the pathway for emotional support, from making each other laugh to consoling each other through hard times. Emotional exchange is the foundation of the good friendship. However, there are some friendships where one person gives while the other person takes. Not surprisingly, bad friendships are quite common. A simple Google search using the term bad friends quickly generates to 324 million results. From published articles to sporty t-shirts, the acknowledgement and commonality of bad friendships is obvious. While not condoning different kinds of friendships, here are some ways to recognize if you are in a toxic relationship, either the taker or giver, and how to change it. While searching the web, the three of the most common types of bad friends are the unaware. Sometimes people say or do things without thinking. Other times, people treat others badly because they grew up in a household that taught them misinformed ways. As a result, some people are unaware that they are bad friends, simply because they don't know any better. These people have an opinion about every part of your life, from whom you should date to what college courses you should take. The unaware believes that they are being a good friend because they have taken the time to analyze your life for you. The unaware will cross boundaries very often, even after you reinforce that you do not want them to cross certain boundaries. Unfortunately, the unaware has a strong compulsion to inject themselves into every part of your life, believing that they have a better perspective of your life than you do. The users. The user has a strong tendency to gravitate toward people who are more than often willing to help them. In fact, most of the time, users will dominate conversations or will only contact you when it's convenient. The user has very little boundaries and is very in tune to certain people who, one, love to help, or two, have a hard time saying no. As a result, the user exploits their friend's loyalty and desire to be needed. The fakers. Fakers are the most toxic friends you can have, simply because the entire friendship is reliant on their personal gain. Fakers have a tendency of having an overly inflated ego with a fragile sense of self. As such, fakers garner friendships with people who they deem less than themselves. For example, a faker will befriend someone who they deem to be less attractive than them to draw more attention from others. Fakers have no boundaries and will become defensive if you call them out on their malicious behavior. In the end, befriending a faker is toxic and can result in negative emotional turmoil. Of the three types of bad friends mentioned, the unaware are the only people that you may want to consider keeping as friends. The users and fakers, however, are emotionally toxic relationships that need to be severed. Severing a friendship can sometimes be arduous, and similar to a breakup, severing a friendship requires one to be direct. If at all possible, try to meet face-to-face in a neutral location. Use this as an opportunity to set or reinforce your boundaries with an unaware friend so that you two can remain friends. For your friend who is either a user or a faker, this is your opportunity to let them know that you no longer see them as a friend and that this is the last time you will be spending time together. You can tell them how you've been hurt by certain situations, but do not be surprised if the user or the faker does not respond sympathetically or with remorse. Building a friendship is tough, but maintaining a friendship is far more difficult. Although being in a friendship puts you in a vulnerable position, sometimes being in these positions teaches more about life and about ourselves. However, if you are going to take the chance of being vulnerable with another person, please make sure that that person respects and reciprocates that vulnerability. Do you recognize yourself or somebody you know as one of these types? Let us know how you dealt with it in the comments below.
Okay. And there we have it. Okay. You guys see the sheet?
Okay. Yeah, I can see it.
All right, so they had a nifty three categories of toxic friends: the unaware friends, the user friends, and the faker friends. What are they? Who can give me a nice synopsis of that? What's the unaware friend?
The unaware friend is the one who doesn't know what they're doing is hurting the other person's feelings.
All right, they're which character on TV is sort of like the classic unaware friend?
Kramer.
What?
Actually, like Kramer.
What show is that? I'm not familiar with that.
Seinfeld.
Oh,
Kramer, right? Good. How about Michael in The Office? He has a classic case of unawareness. So he will say things to people, which is very hurtful. He has belief that whatever he does for them is in their best interest. He has no sense of boundaries. He'll ask the most embarrassing questions. And that, of course, is the essence of the entertainment of the show. So that's the unaware friend. So therefore, they don't respect boundaries. They will, you know, give unsolicited advice about things that you don't want them to be involved in. But it's not because they are pathological, that they just have their sense of awareness, their emotional intelligence is very low. Okay, so that's number one. Then there's the users. What are user friends? Go ahead, Suzanne.
They just take, they don't provide, they're not there emotionally for you, but you're there for them emotionally, and when they need things, they are there to ask, but they're just not available in other ways.
All right, so I'm going to skip over now. All right, good. We'll keep that. And what are the faker friends?
The ones that are using the person. They're not really friends. They're just in the relationship for, like, an ulterior, you know, they have a different motive.
So what's in between the fakers and the users?
The users might be actually friends with the person. They're to, you know, string all of them along because they can, they're using them for whatever. Actually, I don't know. I lost my train of thought.
Okay. Julie, what do you think? What's between the user friends and the faker friends?
I'm sorry, you said user and what's the other one?
Faker friends.
I mean, the user one always asks, which I think was said, without reciprocating in any sort of way, and does it maybe intentionally. And then the taker friend.
Faker with an F.
Oh, faker. It's just not authentic at all, and just it's all about doing it because she has to, or he has to make it for an image, maybe.
Right, some sort of it's a variation of user, but basically the user actually believes typically that they do reciprocate. Now, by the way, all of them will do reciprocation, because otherwise the friendship wouldn't blossom at all. You know what I'm saying? In other words, if they were completely used, if it was a one-way street 100% of the time, right? And if they were fake 100% of the time, then you would have, then the person would have ended the relationship very early on. So the reason why these things drag on is because either consciously or unconsciously, they will reciprocate. They will do acts of kindness to you. They, in other words, you know what I'm saying? There will be reciprocation. There will be an empathy. There will be a sharing of both joy and sorrow. But it'll be just lopsided. And to the point where you're not sure, and they'll say things that are distracting, you know what I mean, that make it unclear. So that's why, you know, now why are these friendships toxic?
Do they drain you?
They drain you. Okay. The unaware one will drain you because they are constantly, you know, you have to deal with sort of like the verbal challenge of them constantly saying things which are mean or inappropriate or make you feel uncomfortable. You have to deal with that emotionally. And the user is like you're working for them. The faker, you're not working for them, but they utilize you in a sort of a sneaky way to somehow augment their, as you said, as Julie said, their profile. Their it's completely superficial. Now, the reality is, we've had class in the past, and I'll just review. The Ram says there are three levels of friends. The first level is where there's an external benefit. We both share. You like playing sports. I like playing sports. We play sports together. So it's mutual. You like to shop. I like to shop. We go play, you know, we do shopping together. You like movies. I like movies. We go movies together. In other words, we have a shared king goal. Or business partner, we have a same mutually beneficial external goal. Then level two friendship is where a person gains a sense of intimacy from the person, where they can share the burden of life. In other words, they can trust them. They feel that they can be themselves. As that word was used, they can be authentic with the person, and they can share both their problems. They can share their dreams, and they feel understood, and it's mutual. Okay, it's a deep friendship. Certainly, husband and wife, boyfriend girlfriend. And then, of course, the highest level of friendship is a friendship of soulmates, where you guys share the shared vision, the things that nurture the soul, which is like ideas, Torah. These things, you have a common quest for meaning is a true soul friend. Okay? So these people are ones that are not even on level three friend. So it's not mutual. It's just usatory. Now, the point is but these friendships can linger for a long time, which is really my psychological question of the night, is how is it possible that if these toxic friends are in fact toxic, then how does the person get faked out for so long? I mean, you see people for years, sometimes even decades. I mean, really, that's really the essence of a divorce. A divorce is, I thought they were really my best friend. Really, they're not. You're either unaware, they're a user, or a faker. You know what I'm saying? That's essentially what's going on. All right? So why does it take so long to recognize that?
Yeah, but how about they may not have been like that, but then, like, life happens, and so people change because of life circumstances. So maybe...
Right, so that's a good point. So first of all, one point is that they were not always toxic. That's one possibility. So one possibility, they were not toxic and they changed. That's one possibility. The second possibility, they were always toxic, but it took a long time to detect that. Now, why is that? Let's go a little deeper into that. Why is that? Why is it hard? Why would it be hard to detect a toxic friend?
Well, I think there's sometimes a level of manipulation with toxic people. Exactly. There's usually underlying personality issues, and they're pretty good at being manipulative, and it's been their way of functioning, so they're probably better than the other person at being that way.
Exactly. In other words, they're very good at being perceiving and promoting themselves as not a toxic friend, but a best friend, a wonderful friend, a caring friend, a concerned friend, a truly beneficial friend. Or that's why they're not, that's why I mentioned before, they don't just use and abuse. It's mixed in with, it's mixed in like a cholent of all kinds of other things. And it takes time, I threw that up for Scott. It takes time to discern that, you know, what's the beans, what's the barley, what's the meat, what's the onion, what's the potatoes. You gotta know what's what. Or maybe sometimes quinoa. So, the bottom line is that gets into a principle I shared this last year, but I want to review it because it's a very important principle called the map is not the territory. The map is what we, our perception is not necessarily, the map is how we navigate, is not exactly what really the terrain really is. I give a little example from the world of business. Suzanne, can you read?
By most accounts, Ron Johnson was one of the most successful and desirable retail executives by the summer of 2011. Johnson's success at Apple was not immediate, but it was undeniable. By 2011, Apple stores were by far the most productive in the world on a per square foot basis and had become the envy of the retail world. Their sales figures left Tiffany's in the dust. The gleaming glass cube on Fifth Avenue became a more popular tourist attraction than the Statue of Liberty. It was a Lollapalooza, something beyond ordinary success, and Johnson had led the charge. With that success, in 2011, Johnson was hired by Bill Ackman, Stephen Roth, and other luminaries of the financial world to turn around the dowdy old department store chain JCPenney. The situation of the department store was dour. Between 1992 and 2011, the retail market share held by department stores had declined from 57% to 31%. The idea was to take the best ideas from his experience at Apple, great customer service, consistent pricing with no markdowns and markups, immaculate displays, world-class products, and apply them to the department store. Johnson planned to turn the stores into little malls within malls. He went as far as comparing the ever-rotating stores within a store to Apple's apps. Such a model would keep the store constantly fresh and avoid the creeping staleness of retail. The idea failed almost immediately. His new pricing model, eliminating discounting, was a flop. The coupon hunters rebelled. Much of his new product was deemed too trendy. His new store model was wildly expensive for a middling department store chain. JCPenney customers had no idea what was going on, and by 2013, Johnson was sacked. The stock price sank into single digits, where it remains 2 years later. What went wrong in the quest to build America's favorite store? It turned out that Johnson was using a map of Tulsa to navigate Tuscaloosa. Apple's products, customers, and history had far too little in common with JCPenney's. Apple had a rabid, young, affluent fan base before they built stores. JCPenney's was not associated with youth or affluence. Apple had shiny products and needed a shiny store. JCPenney was known for its affordable sweaters. Apple had never relied on discounting in the first place. JCPenney was taking away discounts given prior, triggering massive deprival super reaction. The main issue was not that Johnson was incompetent. He wasn't. He wouldn't have gotten the job if he was. He was extremely competent, but it was exactly his competence and past success that got him into trouble. He was like a great swimmer that tried to tackle a grand rapid, and the model he used successfully in the past, the map that had navigated a lot of difficult terrain, was not the map he needed anymore. He had an excellent theory about retailing that applied in some circumstances, but not in others. The terrain had changed, but the old idea stuck.
Okay. So why did Ron Johnson fail?
He used a method for one company that he repeated it and thought it would work with the next company and didn't do a careful enough of an analysis to figure out who the audience was and what all the other factors was to see if it would actually be able to be replicated.
Exactly. That which works for Apple and Apple stores, you know, where you're selling the $1,000 iPhone and never a discount, And, you know, clearly, you know, that's a whole different headspace to JCPenney, which is like, you know, super middle class, super, you know, middle America, and who basically people came there when they were, you know, were drawn because of sales. So his whole, he applied the map. He thought, well, this worked in this retail territory. It'll work in another retail territory. So basically, even very smart and competent people, when they imply their principle, their I'm using the same word, the map to different life territories, often make massive fails. So therefore, going back to our model, many people get stuck into these toxic relationships, friends, relationships, because they have certain, they have outdated maps. Their map about what was really happening is not an accurate depiction of the territory. They think they're in a loving, giving relationship, but really everybody but them sees that they're being manipulated, and they're really, it's really in a harmful circumstance, right? So that's, it's a very challenging thing. That's why you want to always sort of, we're going to get to it. That's why it's very relevant for our parsha, because the big question that I want you to think about as we read the parsha, that Moshe dispatches the 12 spies. They weren't just regular guys. They were literally the princes of the nation. So they were literally the best men. They were leaders. And as you know the story, how many of the spies came back with a good report, and how many came back with a bad report? Remember?
10 and 2.
So 10 came back with what kind of report?
We shouldn't go to the land.
Right, the land is bad. We're going to read inside, and we can't go. And two, Yoshua and Kalev, which we're going to see shortly, saw this land as being beautiful, and we could go in. You have literally two groups with two different maps of the same territory. One place is a disaster, one place is to heaven. One person looking at this is heaven, and another one's looking at hell. So this is the scenario. Let's take a look. Let's go to, all right, so Suzette, keep on reading us out here.
Okay. See what kind of land it is.
This is Moshe giving instruction to the 12 spies, who are truly leaders, 12 princes, and go there and find the following information out.
Are the people who live there strong or weak, few or many? Is the inhabited area good or bad? Are the cities where they live open or fortified? Is the soil rich or weak? Does the land have trees or not? Make a special effort to bring back some of the land's fruits. It was the season when the first grapes begin to ripen. The spies report. When they arrived, they went directly to Moses, Aaron, and the entire Israelite community, who were in the Paran Desert near Kadesh. They brought their report to Moses, Aaron, and the entire community and showed them fruit from the land. They gave the following report. We came to the land where you sent us, and it is indeed flowing with milk and honey, as you can see from its fruit. However, the people living in the land are aggressive, and the cities are large and well fortified. We also saw the giants' descendants there. Amalek lives in the Negev area. The Hittites, Jebusites, and Amorites live in the hills, and the Canaanites live near the sea and on the banks of the Jordan. Caleb tried to quiet the people for Moses. We must go forth and occupy the land, he said. We can do it. We cannot go forward against those people, replied the men who had gone with him. They are too strong for us. They began to speak badly about the land that they had explored. They told the Israelites, the land that we crossed to explore is a land that consumes its inhabitants. All the men we saw there were huge. While we were there, we saw the Titans. They were sons of the giant who descended from the original Titans. We felt like tiny grasshoppers. That's all that we were in their eyes. The people react. The entire community raised a hubbub and began to shout. That night, the people wept. all the Israelites complained to Moses and Aaron. The entire community was saying, we wish we had died in Egypt. We should have died in this desert. Why is God bringing us to this land to die by the sword? Our wives and children will be captives. It would be best to go back to Egypt. The people started saying to one another, let's appoint a new leader and go back to Egypt. Joshua and Caleb respond. Moses and Aaron fell on their faces the whole assembled Israelite community. Among the men who had explored the land, Joshua son of Nun and Caleb son of Jephunneh tore their clothes in grief. They said to the whole Israelite community, the land through which we passed in our exploration is a very, very good land. If God is satisfied with us and brings us to this land, he can give it to us, a land flowing with milk and honey. But don't rebel against God. Don't be afraid of the people in the land. They have lost their protection and shall be our prey. God is with us, so don't be afraid. The whole community was threatening to stone them to death when God's glory suddenly appeared at the communion tent before all the Israelites.
Okay, so they went, they toured the land, they came back, and they show up to Moshe and Aaron, the entire community, give the report. How'd that go? God, how'd that go?
Sorry?
How'd it go when they brought back the report?
It didn't go well.
It did not go well. So, now they start off positive. We came to the land where you sent us indeed flowing with milk and honey, as you can see from its fruit. And then they turn the corner and say, but, however, the people living in this land are aggressive and the cities are large and fortified. And we saw the giants there, and we saw the Amalek and the Hittite and the Jebusite, and everybody's there. And everybody's starting to freak out. Caleb says to be quiet. And he says, no, we can go and do it. We can occupy the land. And everybody says, then the other 10 basically argue, no, we cannot go forward against these people. They're too strong for us. Then they start to add. Then they start to speak badly about the land. All right, so they go on. Let's check out. So, I mean, my question to you is, how is it possible that the 12 most well-educated, refined leaders could have such literally two different visions of the same place? They went together, and they came back with a radically different version of the situation. How is that possible? Anybody have any thoughts? How's it possible that they can go to the same place, call up and Yoshua, say, this place is great. We can do it. We're going to go. And the other 10 says, no, it's beautiful, but it's well fortified. People are aggressive. It's too many. We can't do it.
Could it be if your worldview, if you come from a place of fear, that's what you'll see in life. So it could be they're seeing things with that lens. That's how it's not going to look pretty for them. It will look scary.
Could it also be they were told all sorts of things, you know, during like their time trying to leave Egypt, and then when they left Egypt and on the road, and when they finally got there, you know, what it took to organize the Jews and leave Egypt isn't exactly what it takes to keep them together.
But why? How does that? But how does that reflect upon them saying that we can't do it? We cannot go forward against these people. They're too strong for us. I think picking up.
They were worried about, you know, getting enslaved again.
Oh, so you're saying they were they felt you're saying that since they grew they were slaves in Egypt.
Right,
they don't want to get mentality.
Right.
Therefore, they're more so in a certain sense, you're agreeing with Suzanne. They're coming there and seeing the situation from a lens of weakness from a lens of fear.
Right. Their gut reaction is to be hesitant.
Okay, good.
But it could also be that perhaps like two or three of them were hesitant and then the rest joined in, and there were only two that were willing to take a stand on their own and say like, okay, no, we're going to think differently about this. Because it's like when the masses like gather together, oftentimes like there's one or two people that are yay or nay, and then people gravitate around those people.
Okay, so you're saying that really there were some people who were neutral, but some of the ringleaders within the 10 spies convinced them to have a bad report. Now, the Torah does not openly say that. That's a good theory. But they seem to be speaking as one. Let's take a look at... let's take a look at Rashi. Rashi has some interesting comments. He says there, so the 10 spies say, we can't do it. They are stronger. Go on, read it. So Scott, read it out.
Rashi?
Yeah.
Rashi, for they are stronger. They said this. If this were at all possible, i.e. if one may be permitted to say so of God, with reference to the omnipresent, stronger than he, they thus uttered blasphemy.
Right, so they said, they used the word nimenu, stronger than us, stronger than us, but stronger than he, sort of a double entendre. So Rashi learns that they felt that these people, these 31 kings who occupied the land of Canaan, were stronger than even God. So the men are trying to make a certain point there. Let's check out the Swarno. Go on.
Swarno, it is a land that eats its inhabitants. Even though the people living there are strong, this is not a compliment to the land. Rather, it means that it is only due to their exceptionally hardy constitution that they were able to survive in that land. Ordinary people would die there because the climate is so hard to take.
Right, so they're saying, so they were able to turn everything into a negative. Oh, the strong, healthy people there? Yeah, only the strong and healthy ones can make it, but everybody else dies off. Go on, next Swarno.
Swarno, like grasshoppers, or even less significant, they did not bother to harm us as they did not think we represented a threat to them.
But that's a level of that they view these people are so powerful that these guys looked at them and they didn't bother with them because they just view them as being so insignificant. They weren't a threat. Now, it could be that they didn't think of the possibility that maybe Hashem is helping them out, that they were, that they would not be noticed. You know what I mean? Let's take a look at the Mishnah. We're going to put it all together. All right, we'll go back to Suzanne, Mishnah.
The spies have no share in the world to come, as it says in Numbers 14:37. Even those men that did bring up an evil report of the land died by the plague before the Lord, died in this world, in the plague, in the world to come.
So the Mishnah says something very harsh, that these 10 spies got a double punishment. They were killed by a plague in this world, and they're not getting the world to come. Wow. Now, one of the things they did is because they spoke Lashon Hara about the, they spoke negative information about the land. Okay, so I'm going to go into that in a moment. So here's the deal. So what Moshe wanted to accomplish was like this. He's sending 12 princes. Why is Moshe sending 12 princes? What is he hoping them to do? Especially says, and go check out and tell and bring back information about the quality of the land, the soil, the trees, the fruit. What was Moshe's intent? What was Moshe's outcome that he was hoping for?
Um, an unbiased, clear picture of what's going on there.
And, but the question is, then why do you need spies at all? In other words, just say we're going. It's the land that God promised Abram, and we're now there. Why do you need spies? Why do you need 12 spies? If you need a specific scout, send one or two, which they in fact sent later on. The fact you have 12 spies, one for each tribe, indicates that there was another mission that Moshe wanted to accomplish, which essentially was, he wanted them to go and basically come back with an amazing report to help sell the land. Now, why do you think that did the land of Israel need selling at this particular point as they are standing by the border? Why does the land need selling to the Jewish people?
You mean, like, why did they have to sell, like, where they were going?
Yeah, why did Moshe feel that he needed to have 12 ambassadors go there to the land, get a good report, come back and tell everybody how magnificent the land of Israel is?
That's what he needed. He needed
that. Why did he need that? Why did he need that?
Because it's kind of like what we like talked about earlier, but like these people were coming from like a place of fear. So they needed these spies to come back with like, it's milk and honey. It's amazing. We're going to live peacefully for forever compared to what we had in Egypt. You know, they needed that, like, you know, that, you know, to be comforted, you know.
Exactly. In other words, because the people themselves were feeling anxious, were feeling anxiety, were feeling scared. Therefore, Moshe needed their leaders, a prince of each tribe, to go assess it themselves and come back with a strong and warm and basically sales presentation. Now, you see something very interesting when they show up, and they, let's say they came back scared, which clearly 10 of the 12 did. What should they have done?
I mean, given an honest report.
To whom?
To Moses and Aaron.
Yeah, but where do they go? Look at the first sentence here. This is the poker tell.
When they arrived, they went directly to Moses, Aaron, and the entire Israelite community.
Yeah. You mean like,
so they just went to everyone.
When right. What's wrong with that?
Moses and Aaron didn't have time to vet the message. You know what I mean?
If they were really concerned about the Jewish people's feelings about the land of Israel, and they themselves had personal reservations, what should they have done?
Gone themselves?
Gone themselves to whom?
Down to you know, check out the city.
No, they did already, but then when they came back, and let's say they had came back with concerns. Who should they have given the report to?
Just to Moses and Aaron before everybody else.
Exactly, Scott. In other words, if they had issues, they should go to their leader, which is Moshe and Aaron, and say, guys, we went there, and quite frankly, I don't think we can do it.
Right, and then Moses and Aaron would have had time to been like, okay, kind of let's get all political. And like, you know, how do we spin this? Like,
well, not just spin it, but deal first with their personal concerns. And then make a presentation to the people. But the fact that they want a presentation to the people means that they had it. What was their agenda?
They wanted to make sure that people didn't freak out and be like, we should have stayed in Egypt. At least, you know, we were better off. Now we're going to go be re-enslaved by these giants.
So, right. So they felt that they wanted to block the journey into the land of Israel. They wanted to create a rebellion of the Jewish people. Will now, as they say, let's appoint a new leader and go back to Egypt. Basically, they're trying to undermine the entire mission of the Jewish people. And they do it, by the way. First of all, they start off with factual information. Notice they start factual. Okay. They say, We cannot go forward against those people. They're too strong for us. Okay, that's an interpretation. Maybe yes, maybe no. But then they began to speak badly about the land. So that means that they're sharing negative information. So that's Lashon Hara, okay? So, and then they're starting to giving their own personal interpret, their personal narrative, right? They start to say, oh, one second. The land that we cross to explore is a land that consumes its inhabitants. It literally eats its people, which is Forno. They use the fact that all these strong people are there as the proof, because the only people who can survive are these giants, are these, you know, super strong people, but everybody else dies out. They start to do a negative political campaign against the land of Israel. You know what I'm saying? And to ferment discord. And then were they successful in that? Suzanne?
Yeah, it sounds like they got everyone nervous and excited.
Well, not just nervous. The entire community created a hubbub and began to shout. That night, the people cried. According to the Midrash, what night was that? Anybody know? Julie? What night was the night that the Jewish people cried that the fact that they cannot get into the land of Israel?
Tishbav?
Tishbav is correct. And the Medrash says, tonight you're crying for nothing. Tonight you will ultimately cry for a reason. Both temples were burnt and destroyed on this day of the ninth of. So basically what happened now is, as you guys correctly pointed out, if you have a lens or a map of fear, anxiety, and also, by the way, a lack of emunah, a lack of conviction that God can fulfill his promise. So you look at the situation. There are these nations. There are these kingdoms. There are these armies. You know, this seems to be an impossible task. Yoshua and Kalev say, no, these people are nothing. We saw the 10 plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea, the giving of the Torah. If God wants to help us, these people are nothing, inconsequential. And they did not have a map of weakness, of anxiety, as a fear, like the other 10 spies did. And because of that, they tried to combat that. They were, by the way, rewarded by they did not die in the plague of these 10 spies. And also that when the Jews got punished to remain an additional 38 years in the desert, they lived throughout those years. They did not die like this generation. So the key element here is that it's very possible, and that's the situation, going back to why I use a friend example. You can have a friend. You can see your friend has a friend. And you see that this friend is, in fact, a toxic relationship. They are users. They are fakers. They are completely unaware and say mean and do mean things. But your friend, who also looks at the situation, says, no, I have a lovely friendship here. And it's very hard to convince them that their map of the territory, their perception of things, is false. You know what I'm saying? It's very tricky. Now, these people were not dumb, were not foolish people. They were smart people. But they were in the grip of an emotion of fear that we can't do it. And they were afraid of war. So so much so that the Medrash says that they, as if they were saying that God, even God, these guys are so tough that even God can't destroy them. I mean, which obviously on the surface is ridiculous, because God is the creator of the universe. He can certainly defeat his creations. But they were so overwhelmed with that anxiety. And the fact is, they were not willing to work it out, because if they're willing to work it out, they would have gone and sat down with Moshe and Aaron, and they said, look, we went up there. And I'm being honest here. We're very scared. I don't see how we can do it. You know what I'm saying? I don't see how we can do it. So, But the fact that they made that report in front of everybody and created hysteria and really a campaign to not go in is indicative that their intent from the very beginning was to do what? Was to kibosh, was to undermine this entire episode. Why? One theory, my rabbi, Rabbi Yisrael Chait, suggested was that really they sensed that this is what the people wanted. And as a leader, the question always is, are you giving the people what they need or are you giving people what they want? What they want is not to go fight these inhabitants of the land of Canaan. What they need is to be energized and pumped up that they can do this with God's help. But they could not tolerate it. Then they went to, in order to effectuate their thing, they go into a Lashon Hara campaign, negative speech campaign of slander and libel to undermine the Jewish people. That's why they got such a severe punishment. The Mishnah says they don't get a portion of the world to come because basically that caused the entire generation to die in the desert. So, let's read a little thing about Lashon Hara here. Let's hear from Suzanne.
Our sages said there are three sins for which retribution is exacted from a person in this world and for which he is nonetheless denied a portion in the world to come: idol worship, forbidden sexual relations, and murder. Lashon Hara is equivalent to all of them. Our sages also said, anyone who speaks Lashon Hara is like one who denies God, as implied by Psalms 12:5. Those who said, with our tongues we will prevail, our lips are our own, who is Lord over us? In addition, they said, Lashon Hara kills three people, the one who speaks it, the one who listens to it, and the one about whom it is spoken. The one who listens to it suffers more than.
Okay. All right, so this is a lot of different ideas here. I don't know if we have time to go through each individual one, but the Rambam points out that Lashon Hara is viewed as a very horrible thing, because Lashon Hara is communicating negative information, which is true. So they were saying that true, that these people are very strong, which is a fact. But then they went from that to went into their narrative of saying, and therefore we cannot do it. You know what I'm saying? So they start with true information, which of course gained them credibility, and then went into the negative component. But Lashon Hara also demands, how do we look at people? So you'll take one piece of information which is negative, and what are we saying about this person? When we share a negative piece of information, which is true, about a fellow Jew, what are we really doing? Let's say,
is it like it's supposed?
Jennifer was very insensitive at the Kiddush because she cut me in line to get a piece of kugel. Okay, so let's say that actually occurred and that's actually factually true. Why is the Torah so harsh about people who say Lashon Hara? What's the problem with that?
Because it makes people look bad.
But it's true though.
But still, true or not, you're making them unnecessarily. You're putting
she
out there.
The line. She did go in and she got the kugel before you there, Scott. It's not right. So what's the problem about it?
You're trying to get other people on your side to hate them. Right?
Okay, so you're saying the negative information as part of a part of sort of like a campaign.
Right. You want them to be like,
what really is the essence of the campaign?
To be validated? In your anger or upsetness?
And what, but true, all true. But what are we really saying? When we make that negative, when we say that negative fact about Jennifer, what are we suggesting? Which we're not saying, but we're implying.
That she did it intentionally, not by accident?
Even if she did it intentionally, let's say she did. What else? What else are we suggesting? Going deeper.
That she's, you know, just a generally not a nice person.
Exactly. Exactly, Scott. In other words, we're saying from this piece of information, this is not just a fact. This is a determinative fact. This is descriptive of her very core, her essence, her entire personality. Okay? But the reality is, here's the principle. The opposite is, Havidan Lakol Adam Lakavsko, judge people favorably. Because the reality is that we do not know people. Because when you see people, you're getting little bits and pieces of information. Okay? Now, that has some relevance, but there's so much, we don't have the context. We don't have the full picture about anybody. Therefore, to render judgment on them is a godlike activity. God can make a judgment because he knows all the facts. We cannot make a judgment. You know what I'm saying? And worse, that judgment is what distorted. So just when I say that Jennifer cut in line to get a piece of cocoa before me, okay, so maybe she was super hungry. Maybe she had five reasons to do that. And maybe that wasn't her best moment. But that may not be who she is ultimately and in total. That's a very slender slice of the totality of her personality. So when we speak Lashon Hara about somebody, we're saying that one fact, that's who they are. That's the whole picture. Negative. She's a low person.
Is that why it says the third one, that it kills this person to whom it's spoken?
So it kills that person because basically, fundamentally, when Lashon Hara is shared,
it diminishes that.
The person's reputation is damaged. So the person who speaks it, because they're engaging this activity, which is very harmful. The person who has the damaged reputation obviously is harmed. The person who listens suffers more. Why? Because since they're so passive, they don't really feel they did anything wrong. I was just sitting there. I didn't ask them to say anything. They just told a story. I was just sitting there eating my kugel at the Shabbos table. I didn't ask him to talk about Jennifer. This guy wanted to talk about Jennifer. So it's very hard to in a certain sense, not be affected by that story. You know what I'm saying? And that judgment. But judgment is something really only God is qualified to do. Okay? And our natural vision of people is typically negative. And we don't give the benefit of the doubt. So therefore, and Lashon Hara is depicting the totality of the person from one sliver of evidence, which is not the whole person. So these people use certain pieces of information, the 10 spies use certain pieces of information to promote in the minds of the people that their map of the territory is in fact the true map. And they were successful. And they took the entire Jewish people down. It was a disaster. And those people all died in the desert, never to see the land of Israel. Because they believed, they accepted the Lashon Hara infested view of the map and the territory. Confusing the map with the territory. Because you had Yoshua and Kal says, no, those guys' map is wrong. Our map is accurate. Don't listen to those guys. But they were overruled. So going back to the beginning, so just as we got to be careful about assessing and understanding and validating, exploring our friendships and not getting into traps of, you know, falling into toxic relationships. The Jewish people failed as we parsha by believing their princes, their leaders, and believing their depiction, their Lashon Hara, their negative information infused character assassination about the goodness of the land of Israel. And that really is a, that's why it really comes down to Lashon Hara. Lashon Hara is the careful use of true but negative information to create a distorted and ultimately false picture of a person and ultimately of the land of Israel. And that's something we have to, you know, and, you know, nobody likes to be judged by others. So part of our focus on Lashon Hara, which is appropriate for this week's parsha, is to remember that Lashon Hara is dangerous because it puts into people's minds a false sense of things. Because even if we have one true fact, which we witnessed, which is true, it's not necessarily to be determinative. So maybe there's other factors, there are other considerations, there's different, there's a context to that. So that really is a principle. All right, guys, I'll see you, Scott, I'll see you tomorrow. And
yeah, of course.
And I want to wish everybody a great week.
Thanks.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.